ABC Radio Australia.
We head to Papua New Guinea. They were the talk of the rugby league world when it was announced a club based out of Port Moresby would join the NRL in 2028. But in recent weeks, however, the focus has shifted to another newcomer, the Perth Bears, who would join the NRL a year before PNG in 2027. Unlike PNG, the Bears are close to a finished product. They have long-standing brand forged in North Sydney, an established talent pathway and strong commercial backing. Now, one researcher is wondering if the Bears are an insurance policy for the NRL in case a PNG struggles to get up and running. Hugh Piper is a director at Ancrum Advisory, a strategic advisory services firm in public policy. He's also the editor of The Policy Maker, and he joins us on the line now. With that, I say welcome, Hugh, to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, I appreciate it. I know that you've penned an article for the Lowy Institute on this subject. Why do you get the impression that Perth is somehow some insurance for PNG's NRL team?
Yeah, so looking at this from the NRL's perspective, everything is really about getting to an even number of teams. So, you know, right now that means getting up to 18 from 17 teams since the Dolphins joined in 2023. And what 18 teams means is that there'll be 9 games in most rounds up from the current 8, and that would put the NRL on par with the AFL, its main competition. And, you know, one more game a week essentially means that there's 2 or 3 extra hours of TV content that the NRL can put on the table when it looks to negotiate the TV rights deal for the next deal that starts in 2028. But really, I guess where that 18th team is, whether it's one based in Perth or whether it's one based in Port Moresby, well, for the NRL, that's almost a secondary consideration. And, you know, given that there are already doubts about whether the PNG team will be available and actually able to enter the competition in 2028, one way of looking at, you know, the rush to get Perth in the competition by 2027 is that it's a way that it allows the NRL to guarantee to broadcasters that there will definitely be 9 games in each round from 2028 onwards. You know, there's not a 20th team happening anytime soon, so, you know, it'd be great to see PNG become that 19th team, but that's not, it's important, but it's definitely not essential.
But Hugh, can I ask what factors makes it easier to establish an NRL club in Perth, as opposed to PNG then?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. I think, you know, one of the sort of unfortunate and I guess unintended effects of the Perth Bears announcement has been that, you know, in talking up the benefits of Perth, the NRL has also, I guess, highlighted some of the unanswered questions about a PNG club as well. So I guess if you think through the franchises themselves, as you said in the introduction, the Bears already have a kind of an existing brand, a supporter base that covers both Sydney and Perth. You know, we're yet to see, I guess, the PNG club develop a kind of identity, a brand. You know, will it be based off the Hunters, the existing team that plays in the Queensland Cup, or will it be something different? If you think about the club infrastructure, you know, North Sydney has a like commercially successful leagues club. There's already support for the Bears, plus a kind of talent pathway for juniors. Although there's a big talent base in PNG of juniors, there's no kind of equivalent system. And then if you start to think about like player interest, you know, there's many players and coaches that have already been linked to Perth. It's a much more there's a much more modest level of player interest so far for PNG. And that's before you start to think about, I guess, you know, the places, thinking about Perth versus Port Moresby. You know, WA has a GDP per capita about 25 times larger than PNG. There's a really strong existing professional sports infrastructure in Perth, and then that plays into the commercial opportunities. And as well, you know, Perth, it's a highly developed and safe city, whereas in Port Moresby, you know, there's already been commitments to spend $150 million in addition to the $600 million that's been put on the table for the team just to build a village for the players, coaches and staff to keep them safe. So there's a really strong contrast between the two places, which also makes it, you know, unfortunately a difficult comparison.
Right. Well, Hugh, I know you pointed out that, you know, government financial support is something both PNG and Perth have in common. However, in PNG's case, it serves, you know, a geopolitical purpose. Why could that be a problem maybe long term?
Yeah, so the thing about geopolitics and foreign policy is that it can change, and often rapidly so. So you've got a lot of variables at play here. You know, the political leadership in both Australia and PNG, that can change, whether that be through elections or other means. You know, there's budgetary pressures broadly in Australia on the budget, but even if you drill down, I guess, on the international policy budget, you know, defence expenditure growth is under pressure to increase. And, you know, that money's got to come from somewhere, and this could be a source of it. There's already been queries raised, including by Anthony Galloway from Capital Brief, from an FOI request about how the Commonwealth money is being used as part of this grant of $600 million. Of course, PNG has its own budgetary pressures, given its commitment to spend $150 million of its own money. And then I guess you've got this question of the parallel security agreement that underlies the agreement that the NRL holds, and that's between the Australian government and PNG, that essentially allows the Australian government to withdraw its funding and support if Papua New Guinea enters a security agreement with another power. And I guess the unnamed but obvious power here is China. And so if there's, you know, a shifting balance of power in the Indo-Pacific, including with the lower commitment that we're already seeing from the United States, the foreign policy calculus of PNG and Port Moresby could also shift, and that then puts the team in jeopardy.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What I'm hearing is it sounds like the main priority, though, for the NRL is to get that magic even number right of teams to maximise that TV deal. So then you think Perth is the safer option in the short term? Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say, definitely in the short term. You've got, you know, that established infrastructure, there's players who are super interested in going there, and it's much more viable, I think, to get it up off the ground by 2027 ahead of that next rights deal. And what that does do is give the NRL, I guess, a cushion that means that, you know, if it needs to, the PNG team can be pushed back by 1 or 2 or maybe even 3 years to make sure they get it right and up off the ground before it's introduced.
Well, then let's look at the flip side, though, Hugh, because, you know, Perth has had an NRL franchise in the past that didn't actually succeed. You know, and NRL is also not the preferred code out west. Do you think it's possible that PNG could turn out to be more successful than Perth long term?
So I think, you know, the lesson here is that professional sports franchises in Australia definitely have a mixed record of business success and long-term viability. You know, there's just as many top-flight rugby league sides that used to be in the competition as there are current ones. And one of those is, as you say, the Western Reds, you know, a team that was briefly in the competition in the 90s. Mm. You know, there are big plus factors for the PNG team, especially in comparison to Perth. Like, obviously, as you said, like, local interest is one of those. Rugby league is entering a really crowded market, especially in the winter code over in Perth, whereas rugby league is obviously like the national sport of PNG. And in fact, it's the only country that has rugby league as its national sport. You know, there's a huge amount of local talent, huge amount of passion in PNG about rugby league that probably doesn't exist to the same degree in Perth. And, you know, as well, the Papua New Guinea government is offering tax breaks to Australian players if they'll play in PNG, and that's not something that the Western Australian government is putting on the table for players in Perth. You know, there's definitely, I think, more growth potential in PNG than in Perth. You know, it's a big, wide open market that the NRL can capture in Papua New Guinea, whereas, you know, there's certainly a scenario in which the Perth team kind of caps out at a lower level, whereas the PNG team, once it kind of is established and gets momentum, that could, you know, grow almost exponentially, and there's kind of no cap on where that could go.
Hugh, look, as we wrap up, based on all your research, though, would you at least bet on the PNG club standing the test of time?
Look, I'm not a betting man, but I think, like all rugby league fans, I really want it to succeed. I think now that the expectation has been created in Australia and with the people of Papua New Guinea that there will be a team and it will happen, I think what that means is that for both the Australian government and the PNG government and, I guess, the commercial partners and the NRL, everyone's kind of staked too much, frankly, to let it fail at this point. I think the real question is when it will happen and how much it will cost. But, you know, the risk then becomes that, you know, sunk cost fallacy in if the costs do continue to grow, How much do you continue to invest because of those existing commitments? And at what point might either the Australian government or the PNG or the NRL say enough is enough? This is getting too hard and costing us too much.
Yeah, you, as you said earlier, budget pressures, right? Hugh, look, that's all the time we have for this morning. Some great insight into this situation. But again, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That is Hugh Piper, Director at Ancrum Advisory and Editor of The Policymaker.